From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we hear perhaps the most emulated voice in broadcast journalism, the voice of the man who is arguably the most distinguished journalist in broadcasting, David Brinkley. Also today, we meet the creator of a lesbian feminist mystery series. The sleuth in Barbara Wilson's novels not only solves crimes, but she has to unravel feminist rhetoric. And we have a review of the latest classical recording by pianist Dubravka Tomsic and a roundup of some of this summer's movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Environmental Protection Agency today put an outright ban on almost all asbestos products. Asbestos is known to cause cancer. By taking today's action, the government ended a long debate. EPA Administrator William Riley said asbestos products will be phased out over the next 7 years.
The production and importation bans of the various products that are subject to the rule take effect in 1990, 1993, and 1996. An additional short period of time is allowed for these manufactured products to clear out of the distribution chain.
Riley says asbestos products already in use will continue to be legal because getting rid of them might cause more asbestos pollution than continuing to use them. Federal officials said today investigators made a surprise visit to a former nuclear fuel plant in West Valley, New York, as part of a nationwide probe of environmental safety problems at nuclear facilities. FBI agents and the Federal Department of Energy's so-called Tiger Team of environmental specialists descended on the upstate New York plant looking for evidence of possible violations of federal laws governing hazardous wastes. For the first time in U.S. law, a state's highest court has ruled that a homosexual couple may be considered a family. The ruling came in news involving New York City's complex rent control law. Details from NPR's Mike Schuster.
New York's High Court, the Court of Appeals, ruled today that the gay companion of a man who died nearly 3 years ago has the right as a surviving family member to continue to occupy the rent-controlled apartment the two lived in for 10 years. We conclude, the Court of Appeals said, that the term family should not be rigidly restricted to those people who have formalized their relationship by obtaining a marriage certificate or an adoption order. The ruling has been hailed by gay rights activists as a groundbreaking decision. The opinion came in the case of Miguel Brasci, who lived with Leslie Blanchard for a decade. Blanchard died in 1986 from complications resulting from AIDS. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
Housing and Urban Development Secretary Jack Kemp said today he's canceling a program designed to house the elderly because tens of millions of dollars have been lost to waste and mismanagement. Kemp suspended the Retirement Service Center program, saying that in addition to costing the government millions of dollars, it has failed to serve the low-income elderly. It is the third program Kemp has placed on hold because of fraud and poor management during the Reagan administration. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev said today he would make new cuts in his country's nuclear arsenal if NATO would agree to talks on eliminating all short-range nuclear missiles from Europe. The offer came in Gorbachev's speech to the Council of Europe. It was quickly turned aside by NATO. The alliance is standing by its plan to negotiate only partial cuts. This is NPR News. A man shouting, "God is great," in Arabic seized the steering wheel of a bus on Israel's busiest highway today and steered it onto a 200-foot ravine. 17 people died. Another 24 are injured. No one on board escaped. Police say they have a Muslim fundamentalist extremist in custody. The State Department today made a new appeal to Palestinian Arabs to participate in elections on the West Bank and Gaza. But the PLO said tough conditions set by Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir have effectively put an end to the peace process. Barry Schwide has more.
The State Department tried to draw a distinction between the conditions set by Prime Minister Shamir at a convention of his Likud party and the election proposal itself. The proposal has U.S. blessing and was approved in May by the Israeli cabinet. It remains, in the view of the Bush administration, the only feasible way of getting negotiations started. So, through spokesman Richard Boucher, the State Department urged Palestinians to work out details with the Israelis and to participate. Still, Boucher was critical of Shamir's conditions, which rule out yielding territory while granting Palestinians local self-rule. He said partisan declarations, particularly if they appear to be more restrictive or to impose conditions, do not advance the peace process. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
A key figure in several of Wall Street's recent financial scandals got a suspended sentence today, but will still have to pay $250,000 in fines. Former stockbroker Boyd Jeffries pleaded guilty 2 years ago to securities fraud charges. He was involved in trying to sanitize the illegal stock dealings of big-time stock manipulator Ivan Boesky. President Bush today awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to five Americans, the highest official honor given to civilians. The late comedian Lucille Ball was awarded the medal posthumously, and George Kennan, a former U.S. ambassador to Moscow, also received the award. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. As David Brinkley has pointed out, he started doing TV news before anyone was watching. And when he stopped anchoring in 1979, he noted that he'd done the news longer than anyone else on Earth. Brinkley joined NBC in 1943. From 1956 to 1970, the name of Brinkley was usually paired with Huntley. It was the Huntley-Brinkley Report that made Brinkley one of TV's first celebrated anchors. After Chet Huntley retired, Brinkley co-anchored the NBC News with John Chancellor and became a commentator. In 1981, he joined ABC, where he began the still-popular Sunday morning program This Week with David Brinkley. Brinkley's book, Washington Goes to War, has just come out in paperback. It chronicles how World War II transformed Washington from, quote, a small provincial town into the capital of the free world, unquote. Brinkley remembers what Washington was like when he first moved there in 1943.
The war had begun, of course, but it was still essentially a country town, slow-moving. People in Washington who had big business activities went to Baltimore to borrow money, because that's where the big banks were. People read the Baltimore Sun more than they read any Washington paper, because at that time we didn't have a really good paper. There were no restaurants to speak of. There was no theater to speak of. There was not much of anything to speak of. It was a sort of a fried-in-grease town.
How big was the press corps?
Not very. Nothing like what it is today. I would say, I don't really know the answer, but I would guess a few hundred.
Oh, that's pretty small.
It's in the thousands, now.
Now, you were the White House correspondent, weren't you, for, was it NBC Radio?
NBC, well, that's radio was all it was then.
Right, okay, so... Listen, I figure it must have not been considered a very important beat if such a young man or someone still really a rookie was assigned to the White House in the early 40s.
Well, partly because I got out of the Army early and everybody was crying for male help. Female help was not as welcome then as it is now. All kinds of changes have taken place. And the White House was not really a full-time beat. The president had press conferences twice a week, one on Tuesday morning and one on Thursday afternoon. I may have those reversed, because they were intended only for newspapers. And reporters showed up at the appointed hour, went to the press conference, and left. And there were only five or six who were there all day, and there was no reason to be there all day because not much was happening. There was no such thing as a leak at that time.
So that was the White House beat, huh? You just covered
pretty
the
much. You showed up twice a week for the press conference and left.
You point out that radio became a medium that was taken seriously as a news medium during World War II. Did you take radio very seriously when you were working in it? Did you think of it as the place you wanted to continue to work? And again, this was before television.
I did take it very seriously. I thought it was terribly important during the war more than ever before. People stayed glued to the radios because we had tremendous amounts of news. And I remember putting on all kinds of things during the war that the newspapers would not have until the next morning. And there were people all over the country who kept the radio on all day long and had a map. And they put pins in the map to keep track of activity on the war fronts as the radio reported them. And we had some very, very good reporters in those days reporting the war from the war fronts. I never did that. And so radio became a very serious and highly respected news medium.
Now, I learned from your new book that NBC used to insist that after 6 in the evening, men had to wear formal attire and black tie. How long did that regulation last, and what was the rationale for it?
Well, the rationale was that NBC wanted to be considered what it was for a long time, the foremost radio network. It was a serious enterprise. Everything on the air was live. Everything. There was not even a recorded commercial. Everything was live. And they wanted to maintain a high degree of dignity and seriousness and public acceptance, and so in the photographs of radio performers at night, Fred Allen, big names in those years, all wore black tie. The announcers wore black tie. Everyone wore black tie.
Of course, no one listening to the radio could see them.
I know that. But,
yes, I figured you'd know that, yeah.
had an effect on the... They thought it had an effect on the performance of their people.
Did you buy that yourself?
Well, I don't know. I didn't own the network, and if that's what they wanted, it was okay with me. It didn't matter.
Did you have to keep a change of clothes with you, so if you had a report after 6, you'd have your formal attire?
Yes. Yes. They stopped that eventually. I don't remember exactly what year they stopped it, but they did stop it. I think when television came along, they dropped it.
Now, was that sense of formality carried over into The Voice as well? Were you expected to sound very formal, especially in the evening hours?
Well, people in radio at that time took their diction and their speech patterns very, very seriously. I remember announcers saying in tones of awe that, what's his name, who used to announce a Metropolitan Radio, a Metropolitan Opera broadcast, Milton Cross, was he Milton
yeah,
Cross?
Yeah,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
Milton Cross. They spoke of him as if he were some kind of deity because he had won a prize for having the finest diction in radio. It was good.
Now, you really have perhaps the most consciously or unconsciously imitated voice in broadcasting. How was your voice regarded when you first started working in radio? Were you considered to have a good radio voice?
I don't know that anybody paid any attention. I never heard anything about it or never thought anything about it. I don't know. I can't answer that.
Mm-hmm. I know that there were many preachers in your family, and I was wondering if they're... style of oratory affected you at all?
Because I never went to hear them.
Oh, really?
No, they were. This is before my time. There was a line of Presbyterian preachers in my background, but by the time I was old enough to go to church, and I can't say that I went, even though I was old enough very often, they were all gone.
When did you first become aware that other people in broadcasting were picking up your inflections?
I guess the first time was when somebody ran an ad in Variety, the little show business newspaper, weekly newspaper, ran an ad in Variety offering $1,500 for somebody who could record a commercial for 1 minute using my speech pattern. And the joke at the time was that I applied for it and was turned down, which is, of course, not true, but that was the joke. I don't know anymore. I shouldn't tell this because I don't know what finally happened.
David Brinkley is my guest, and his book, Washington Goes to War, has just been published in paperback. Well, while we're talking about your voice, let's talk a little bit about writing. You've been praised so much for knowing how to write a simple declarative sentence and for writing really clear, concise copy for television. How did you develop your style of writing for radio and TV?
Well, I worked for United Press, which at that time had what it called a radio wire. I guess it still has it. It goes only to radio stations, and they thought I could write well, so they put me to work writing for the Radio Wire. And it attracted some attention because it was pretty good, I guess, and NBC hired me as a writer to write news scripts for announcers to read, which is how the news was done then. And one reason I learned to write clearly and simply was that I had to write in such a way that the announcers, who knew nothing of what they were reading, that the announcers could not read it wrongly. And so they would emphasize the right word and not change the meaning of the sentence by emphasizing a wrong word.
Would you ever let anyone write for you? Did anyone ever write for you in your years of anchoring?
No.
Did you ever try it and have a bad experience?
No. Well, a time or two, for whatever reason, I had to read something because something happened while I was on the air. I had to read copy written by someone else, and I found I simply could not do it. I can't do it.
Well, why not?
I don't know. I just can't. I'm used to reading my own, saying my own words, and I cannot say somebody else's.
When you say you cannot say it, does that mean that you trip over the words?
It means that I garble it all up. So what I've always had to do, this hadn't happened much. When it did happen, I first had to read it and then ad-lib it. I can't read other people's copy.
Does that have to do more with not liking other people's writing, or more with needing sentences that fit your inflections?
The second, needing sentences that fit my inflections. I can't read other people's sentences. I simply can't.
Mm-hmm. Now, something else that you did as a writer and as an anchor was to allow an element of irony and detachment. Were you ever criticized for that early on, before it became recognized as your style?
I think I probably was, yes.
Do you remember exactly for what reasons?
For that reason, that I was ironic and sounded detached. And some critics wrote that, and if I were asked how I reacted, the answer is I didn't.
What about executives? Did they criticize you?
The executives, generally speaking, didn't know a cliché from third base. They wouldn't have known it anyway. The executives in radio, when I was in radio, really didn't know much about it, much about news. What they knew about was soap operas and Fred Allen and Charlie McCarthy and so on. They didn't know anything about news.
What about in television, though, when you were ironic and somewhat detached in your readings?
Well, by that time, I think we'd all grown up, and they knew who I was and what I was, and I knew I wasn't going to change and couldn't if I wanted to, so no one ever complained about it. The only complaints I've ever heard have been from critics in print, mm-hmm. newspapers and so on. Mm-hmm. And very little of it, but it has been there.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is David Brinkley, and his book Washington Goes to War has just been published in paperback. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
David Brinkley is my guest, and his account of how both the politics and culture of Washington, D.C. were changed by World War II, the book Washington Goes to War, has just come out in paperback. You've said that you learned to do TV before anyone was watching, and I guess that's pretty true. And by 1950, you were doing regular reports on the Camel News Caravan?
John Cameron Swayze and the Camel News Caravan. It was perfectly awful, Terry.
Why was it awful?
Well, partly because when one set out to do a television news program at that time, there was no history to go by. No one knew how to do it. It had never been done before. And you are not old enough to remember, but in the past, there were, in the movie theaters, newsreels between the features. And they were perfectly awful. They were owned by the movie studios, and mainly they used them to clear out the theater between features so people wouldn't sit through them twice. And there were dull, boring, silly stories about ship launchings, horse races, fashion shows, and so on. So when television came along and decided to do news, they didn't know what to do except to copy the newsreels, which is what they did. And the Swayze program, which I did do a little bit of, was, as I say, perfectly awful. It was ship launchings and fashion shows and other kinds of junk. No news, really. Not much.
Well, this was before there were rules about what made good television, and I would think that would leave you free to take certain risks and experiment a little.
Free to, but not really able to, because the facilities were so bad. The film was black and white. The sound was optical sound, very poor. It took forever to get film processed, and forever beyond that to get it edited. When it came from out of the city, New York or Washington, it had to be flown in and very often got lost at the airport. It was really a mess. So all we did was struggle and try to get something on the air, and that's about all we accomplished.
Well, in 1956, you became the co-anchor of the NBC News with Chet Huntley, mm-hmm. the Huntley-Brinkley Report. Was anchoring at that time considered a real high-prestige position in the way that it's subsequently been seen?
Nothing like it has come to be since then. It was then thought of as a kind of interesting job. There weren't any real anchors before that. There was John Cameron Swayze, and on CBS along later came Doug Edwards. And on ABC, I don't think they were in the game yet. So there wasn't much. Anchoring didn't amount to much. There wasn't much to anchor. The programs are 15 minutes long. The pictures are bad. The sound was bad. Very few people had television sets. And so it didn't really amount to much. It later came to be what it is. Whatever that is, I'm not sure I know.
Do you mind me asking a question? I know you've been asked a million times. But about how you were paired with Chet Huntley.
NBC thought at that time, the big name, biggest name in news at that time prior to that was Ed Murrow. And every network felt it had to have an Ed Murrow or somebody who sounded like him. NBC hired Chet Huntley, thinking he sounded like Ed Murrow. And he was in New York, and I was in Washington. For the first time, they'd resolved to cover a political convention thoroughly, because finally we had some cameras and so on, were able to do it. And they were unwilling to trust either of us alone, and so they put the two of us together, thinking that if one of us screwed up, the other could save him. There have been many arguments about who was responsible for that decision, but somebody in New York made it, and we did do the 1956 convention together. And it worked very well, and it led to the Huntley-Brinkley news report in fall of 56.
Now, I understand that you really didn't like the famous sign-off that you used every night.
I didn't.
Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Why not? It doesn't seem very offensive.
Well, it seems silly to me. It seemed that when we said good night, we should say good night to the audience. We are there to tell them the news, not to tell each other. Were there. And I didn't think it sounded too good, two men saying good night to each other on the air. We should say good night to the audience. And I fought and argued and fought and argued and lost. The producer insisted that we say goodnight, Chet, and goodnight, David. So finally we gave in, and we did, and it became, for a long time, part of the language.
Since it caught on, do you think that you were wrong, or do you think that you were right?
Well, I don't know. Who's to say? But yeah. It caught on, and so I couldn't argue anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were first paired to cover a convention together, and you've said that you have always really liked covering conventions. You've thought of them as kind of big parties, big games, a lot of excitement. I was wondering what you felt at the Chicago convention. In the Democratic Convention in 1968?
68?
Yeah.
I felt I was in a foreign country. I was shocked by what was happening out there in the streets. Students being beaten by the police. The mayor of Chicago turning out the sewer workers to fill up the auditorium to cheer him and to hold up signs saying, "We love Mayor Daley." It truly was shocking and somewhat frightening. I remember that was at about the time when the Russians had gone into Czechoslovakia to shut down the democratic movement there under Dubček. And I remember saying on the air, "Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?" Well, the mayor, needless to say, didn't like that, but it was true. I was shocked by it and infuriated by it.
Now, did you get any flack for saying that? Are we in the United States or are we in Czechoslovakia?
I got some flack from Mayor Daley, but not much from anybody else. I think everybody else outside of Chicago was shocked at what happened there.
Mm-hmm. David Brinkley is my guest. You know, on your Sunday morning show this week with David Brinkley, one of the weekly participants and commentators is Sam Donaldson. And I wonder if you think things have changed in terms of where the line is drawn for a reporter or an anchor being allowed to express opinions on the air.
It's a good question, and it's a question that none of us has ever really been able to figure out in a satisfactory way. Obviously, when Sam is on the air with me and George and whoever else on Sunday mornings, he is not giving the news. We are having a discussion. We're not saying what happened. We're saying what we think about what happened, and it is clearly labeled. No one is deceived by it. Nevertheless, there are people who think reporters, people who report news in an objective, though I don't like that word, fashion, should not sometime later on the same station, same channel, be giving his opinions. And as I say, I can't really satisfy myself on that point. I still have questions about it.
Let me ask you this. The two people who I assume are supposed to be political balance to each other are George Will as the conservative and Sam Donaldson as the liberal. But it always seems to me that George Will is further to the right than Sam Donaldson is to the left. And I was wondering if you think of them as an equal balance.
I don't really think of it in those terms, Terry. I don't think political opinion can be measured by some kind of micrometer. What you say may well be true, but if asked to prove it, I would have a hard time doing it. George is quite conservative, and Sam is sort of liberal. He's not a red-hot, screaming left-winger, but he's sort of liberal. And he very often disagrees with George, and I'm delighted. Otherwise, we would miss a lot of chances for opinions to be exposed and discussed because everybody agreed. It'd make a fairly boring program, actually.
Where do you think of yourself as falling in the political spectrum?
I have spent my entire working life avoiding any political label.
Mm-hmm.
The only answer I can give you is that depending on what it is, I am either a liberal or a conservative. That's no answer, I know, but I can't give you an answer. It depends on what the question is.
Mm-hmm. When people come on your show on Sunday morning, I'm sure they come on determined to just say what it is that they've decided to say beforehand, and then it's your job and the jobs of the other people on the show to try to get them to go beyond what they've prepared in advance. Is that very difficult to do, and do you think of yourself or as the other people on the program as having certain techniques of pushing people further than they planned to go?
Yes, everything you say is true. Everyone we have on the air, usually it's some sort of political figure or an academic figure or some sort of intellectual figure, every one of them will arrive in a studio with some little sermonette in mind and determined to deliver it. So one thing I do is first ask them a dull, boring question like, what do you think about this? And let them deliver their little sermonette. And then we get to the hardcore of what we're there to talk about.
You have to
let them get it out of their system before they will go into anything else.
That sermonette can be kind of long. How do you make sure it's
a concise
sermonette?
Interrupt. I don't let them run on all night. They do that before they come, and if they try to go into a filibuster, I had one not long ago and from the SNL industry who wanted to filibuster, and I stopped him. I cut him off. I do it politely, but we do it.
You started on television before there was videotape, so you couldn't watch a tape-delayed broadcast of your show. You couldn't watch the videotape and see how you were doing. Do you remember the first time you actually watched yourself on videotape, what the experience was like?
I remember I didn't like it. And I didn't like how I looked and sounded, didn't like anything about it. And I've almost never looked at myself since. I'm serious. I mean that. Our Sunday program at 10:30 is done live. At 11:30, we play back the tape to the West Coast and so on. I could easily sit and watch it all. I never, ever watch it.
And why not?
I don't want to look at myself. I don't know why not. Maybe I'm crazy.
But do you ever think, well, you should overcome that feeling so you could see the show and critique it and see if there's anything you wanted to change?
Since I was on it, I know what is on the program.
Right.
And I know what I think was pretty good and what I think was less than good. And so I don't really need to do that to critique it. But as for looking at myself, it really doesn't appeal to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't do it. I truly almost never have done it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the news and about your broadcasting career. Thank you very much for your time.
Terry, thank you. I've enjoyed being with you.
I've enjoyed it. My guest has been journalist David Brinkley, and his account of how both the politics and culture of Washington were changed by World War II, a book called Washington Goes to War, has just come out in paperback. And, of course, you can see This Week with David Brinkley Sunday mornings on ABC. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be writer Mae Sarton. She's written over 35 novels, books of poetry, and essays, but she's probably best known for the journals she's written in the past 10 years about aging, sexuality, solitude, and her recovery from a stroke. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Barbara Wilson wanted a setting for her latest mystery novel, she chose one of the thorny issues in the feminist community, the debate between the anti-porn and pro-S&M factions. Coming up, Barbara Wilson talks about the dog collar murders and the lesbian feminist sleuth who solves the mystery. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording by Yugoslavian pianist Dubravka Tomsic. She studied in America and played Carnegie Hall as a teenager, and now America is discovering her all over again. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews a trio of summer movies, Great Balls of Fire, Lethal Weapon 2, and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Michael Richards. Most uses of the cancer-causing fiber asbestos will be phased out over the next 7 years. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator William Riley announced the ban today, saying industry's use of the fiber has left a legacy of people who are dead, dying, or crippled. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports.
Most companies stopped using asbestos in products from clothing to floor tiles at least a few years ago, because they expected the government would eventually ban asbestos anyway, and because they wanted to avoid being sued by workers or consumers who might get sick. Between 70 and 100,000 workers have already sued asbestos producers and other companies on the grounds that being exposed to the fibers caused lung cancer and other fatal diseases. The EPA ban announced today will phase out asbestos use between now and 1996 in the last two industries which continue to use large amounts of the fiber: the auto industry, which makes asbestos brake linings and other parts, and the construction industry, which mixes asbestos with cement in water and sewage pipes. EPA Administrator William Riley estimates that the ban announced today will save at least 200 workers in these industries who would have died from cancer otherwise. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
NATO officials in Brussels say the latest disarmament proposals by Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev will not change NATO's plans on short-range nuclear missiles. Earlier today, Gorbachev suggested his country would make unilateral cuts in its short-range arsenal if NATO opened negotiations on the subject. Roger Morier reports from Strasbourg, France.
Gorbachev made the proposal in a speech before the Council of Europe, the assembly of 23 West European nations in Strasbourg. The Soviet leader said it was high time that both NATO and the Warsaw Pact started negotiating the reduction or elimination of all short-range nuclear missiles on the continent. With greater European unity, said Gorbachev, with more cooperation between East and West, no one in Europe would want a war, so no one needs the short-range missiles. Gorbachev said if NATO agreed to start negotiations on removing the weapons soon, that he would probably dismantle some Soviet missiles without even waiting for the outcome of the talks. Gorbachev also said all foreign troops in Europe should be pulled out of the countries in which they are stationed, and he called for the dismantling of military blocs, saying they should be replaced by a political dialogue. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Maurier in Strasbourg, France.
China today rejected a U.S. protest that Chinese soldiers deliberately took shots at an apartment complex last month, a complex that houses foreign diplomats. The incident took place during troop maneuvers to put down student-led protests in Beijing. China said the soldiers at the diplomatic compound were going after a sniper. The Chinese National People's Congress today condemned prominent intellectuals who've been in the forefront of the country's reform movement. It appears that the condemnation signals a broader crackdown on dissent. The official report also condemns ousted party chief Zhao Ziyang for not acting more decisively to end the street protests. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. The Yugoslavian pianist Dubravka Tomsic launched her career in America when she was a teenager. She was a student of Arthur Rubinstein, played with the New York Philharmonic, and made her debut at Carnegie Hall before she returned to Yugoslavia. Last year, she was rediscovered in this country on a number of critically acclaimed compact discs. Next Monday, Tomsic returns to the U.S. to open the Newport Music Festival in Newport, Rhode Island. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of her latest recording.
If it weren't for recordings, Americans might not have had the chance to learn about a wonderful musician named Dubravka Tomsic. Recordings she made in Yugoslavia, from Bach and Scarlatti to Tchaikovsky and Grieg, suddenly turned up last year on two budget labels, Stradivari and PMG. Here was a pianist whose elegant and serious musicianship called to mind the very greatest 20th century keyboard artists. Her latest recordings confirm that impression. Stradivari has issued her splendid Emperor Concerto, and now, just in time for her return to America, I must resist calling it her American debut, here's an extraordinary disc with Chopin's first piano concerto and the Mozart concerto probably most popular in Chopin's time, the so-called Coronation Concerto. Let's start with some Chopin. Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 1 was actually written and performed shortly after his Piano Concerto No. 2, but it was the first to be published. It was one of the last pieces Chopin composed before he left Poland, never to return. Conductor Marco Mugni, leading the superb Ljubljana Symphony Orchestra, provides the sort of spacious accompaniment that allows Tomsic room to play not only with the greatest lyrical intimacy, but also when the music calls for it, with broad, heroic power. Here's Dubrovka Tomsic in the Romanza, the nocturne-like slow movement that Chopin himself described in a letter as gazing on a beautiful landscape that evokes in the soul beautiful memories. For example, on a fine moonlit spring night. For this reason, he adds, I have muted the string accompaniment. It's shocking to learn that at the premiere of the concerto, the first movement was followed not by the second movement, but by an aria with chorus composed by Chopin's conductor. Then Chopin played the rest of the concerto. At least some things change for the better. Mozart's Coronation Concerto, number 26 in D, is his next-to-last piano concerto, and it's rather different from his other late piano concertos, especially the very last. It's one of his least personal, written primarily as a brilliant display piece for himself. Not that it's without poignance, but the poignance is more formal, more public. Tomsic changes her whole stylistic approach to play Mozart. Her Chopin is all legato and broad chords, her Mozart all crisp clarity. Yet Tomsic never sectionalizes the music. Her sense of continuity, of the architecture of each work, is equally impressive. Thank you. Mozart is conducted by the exceptionally gifted Anton Nanut, who leads the Ljubljana Symphony in most of Tomsic's other concerto recordings. Good things seem to be going on in Yugoslavia.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording by Dubravka Tomsic on the Stradivarius record label. This is Fresh Air. Louis Marsh is a prominent anti-pornography activist and a superstar in the feminist lecture circuit. At a conference on sexuality, she's found strangled by a dog collar. Was it the same dog collar worn earlier that day by a sadomasochist at the conference? That's the mystery in Barbara Wilson's new novel, The Dog Collar Murders. It's the third novel about lesbian feminist sleuth Pam Nilsson. Barbara Wilson is also the founder of The Seal Press, which publishes feminist books, including her own. She says she started writing detective novels as an entertaining way of combining action and feminist politics. Her mysteries not only investigate murders, they investigate life in the lesbian feminist community. In the opening of the new novel, Pam and her lover attend the wedding of Pam's heterosexual twin sister, Penny.
If this has been one of the novels we used to read, or one of the stories Penny used to tell me, then I should have been the happiest girl on earth now. My twin sister was getting married to the man she loved, and I was the bridesmaid. Of course, some things weren't quite the way we might have imagined them. Instead of a white lace dress and gossamer veil, Penny was wearing an embroidered blouse and a hand-woven skirt from Guatemala. And instead of tossing me a bouquet after the ceremony, she handed me her baby so she could kiss the groom. I kissed the groom, too. After all, he'd been my lover once for nearly 2 years. And Penny kissed my partner. On the mouth, Hadley said later. Then I kissed Penny and handed baby Antonia back to her, and we all trooped out of the house into the garden for the reception. Hadley came up behind me and put her arms around my waist. Her hair smelled good, of fall and herb shampoo, and she was wearing a new light wool jacket that rubbed pleasantly on my bare arms. Always a bridesmaid, never a groom, she said. It's also reactionary, I muttered, while smiling at the arriving guests and directing them to the happy pair. If I were the one getting married, to you, for instance, do you think all these people, all these relatives and friends of the family would be turning up? No way. Some of them don't seem so pleased to see that Penny has an 8-week-old baby at her breast, Hadley noted. I think the baby's supposed to be a gentle swelling under the bride's dress, so people can gossip and speculate.
You've made Pam a woman who only recently became a lesbian. What's interesting about that is that this way she's new to the lesbian community, and she can always be examining it and discovering it and seeing things that people who've been a part of that community for a long time might not notice anymore.
Yeah, that's true, though it's kind of funny because I started this series of novels about her 6 years ago, so not very much time has passed in the world of the novel, so she's still kind of in that state perpetually, which is a little bit tiring for me sometimes.
But did you want her initially to be in that state?
Yeah, and I'm interested in her position as somewhat of an outsider because it enables her to look with maybe fresh eyes on some of the questions of the lesbian feminist community.
By giving her a heterosexual twin sister, you've enabled her to always be looking over her shoulder saying, what if I was still a heterosexual? Would I have a baby? Would I want a baby? Would I want to be married? There's always this sense of resentment there, too, between the two sisters.
Yeah, and I think that it's a way of involving the reader in what it's like to be a lesbian, if the reader is straight, for instance. And many of us do have family who don't accept us. So it's a real question for Pam.
The Dog Collar Murders is about the division between anti-pornography feminists and lesbian feminists who are into sadomasochism. So you've chosen two real extremes on sexual issues. Why did you want to set it in that issue?
Well, I think that most of my novels have come out of questions that I'm interested in myself and I don't know the answers to. So I think that, for instance, in Sisters of the Road, I talked about prostitution because that was an issue that I didn't know what I thought about it. And the same with pornography. I mean, like most other people, I've been listening to the debates for at least 10 years, and my feelings have gone back and forth. In some ways, I think The Dog Collar Murders is less about pornography than it is about rhetoric and styles of rhetoric. Because in actual fact, there aren't just two positions, even though there often seem to be the anti-pornography versus the anti-censorship feminists. There are the Christian fundamentalists. There are artists who want to create some kind of lesbian eroticism. There are socialist feminists who wonder why everyone is talking about this issue anyway when there are much more important things to discuss. And that was very interesting for me as I began my reading to decide that there were not just two positions, but maybe six or so.
So one of the women who is against pornography is strangled with a dog collar, and that's the murder that sets things in action.
Right.
So is this a roman à clef? Do you have friends on the lecture circuit who are wondering if they're the basis of any of the characters in the book?
It's not. I tried to be pretty careful in drawing Loie Marsh to make her not like anyone in particular, but to resemble many women. I think that I'm a little bit younger than some of the famous feminists of the 70s, and like many women, I grew up hearing speeches sort of year after year from these women who were the founders of modern feminism, and I think that they take themselves quite seriously in lots of ways, and I think that there's an effort to sort of reevaluate those speeches and the kind of the tone they have in their speeches of knowing what's best for the rest of us. And I think it's that tone, in a way, that I was trying to critique more than any one person.
Mm-hmm. I think you're also critiquing the way some women relate to the, quote, stars of the feminist movement as symbols and not as full human beings.
I think that's very true, and I think that still continues. I wasn't at a conference in New York in April of 87, but I listened to tapes of it, and there's so much that goes on between the audience and the stars in terms of the audience sort of screaming their names and agreeing with them and clapping at everything they say. It's real interesting to listen to from a distance.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, before you said that you see this novel as being about rhetoric, and it's interesting to read some of the rhetoric of women who are involved with sadomasochistic practices. Like, for instance, you quote one of the women during this investigation as saying, sadomasochism isn't about force, it's about exploring limits. And that's an explanation for why she doesn't think it was a sadomasochist who committed the murder, because it's not about force, it's about exploring limits. I think, you know, sadomasochism has become so intellectualized.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the things that interests you in this, how that's happened?
Yes. Well, that's the rhetorical side of the novel, in that sadomasochism has some brilliant exponents like Pat Califia and Gail Rubin, who have written long theoretical works on what is important and interesting about sadomasochism. In a book like Coming to Power, they have long, very interesting essays. But I also think that when you contrast those essays with some of the other or first-person fantasies in the book, it's somewhat disturbing. And I think that many feminists are intellectually interested in sadomasochism, but the reality is sometimes a little bit different.
So, Barbara, you've written this book about the sex debates, and it's a very, very chaste book.
Yeah, that's true. I'm interested in exploring sexuality in in different ways from how I see many people exploring sexuality today. I mean, there's a lot of interest in eroticism, but I don't see eroticism as divorced from my characters, and I have to think, what would my characters do? What would they think about? I'm interested in writing sex scenes that aren't necessarily meant to titillate, but to ask questions. For instance, there's a scene that I really like in The Dog Collar Murders where Pam and Hadley go to see some videos that have been made by a lesbian erotic video maker, and Pam has been suspecting that they're just going to be what she thinks of as porn, but instead they're very deconstructionist and very intellectual, and most of the audience is having fits because they don't think that it's sexy at all. So there's a big debate about whether these are sexy or not. And that was really fun for me, to write sexual images that were undercut by people asking questions about them.
Mm-hmm. So have your views changed in the course of writing this book, in the sex debates?
No, I think I'm still confused. I think that I'm not a great theoretical thinker. I never have been, and I never will be. If I have a talent, it's putting words into other people's mouths. And I think that the issues are very complicated, which is why I split them up and let people explain different parts of them. Many theoreticians are interested in building a single system or structure, and they get so caught up in proving their own point of view that they have to mute contradiction and criticism. And I'm very interested in contradiction. I think it's interesting, and as a fiction writer, I deal in contradiction. So after having written the book, I do get asked, well, you have read so much about this, you must have decided what you think. But in actual fact, everything I read still after the book makes me think, oh, that's an interesting side, I didn't think of that. Or, oh, I should have explored that in the book, because new things keep coming up.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Barbara Wilson's new novel, The Dog Collar Murders, is published by Seal Press. Wilson spoke to us from KUOW in Seattle. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing about Mikhail Gorbachev's trip to France that's now ended, and also Jacques Rupnik, a French-Russia watcher, East European watcher, talks to us about why the Gorbachev visit to France was something of a letdown. We also have a report from correspondent John Itzty today about 1992, you know, 1992 meaning the moment at which Europe will actually move toward a single economic market. John's focus is the telecommunications industry, something the U.S. is very good at. Will the larger market in Europe be an opportunity for U.S. industry, or will it essentially be closed off to the U.S., and will it be bad news for America that Europe finally will be one big market?
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For those of you trying to decide what movie to see this weekend, film critic Stephen Schiff recommends what to see and what to avoid.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Getting this get wrecked, just quitting balls of fire.
If Great Balls of Fire the movie were for even a single moment as exhilarating as Great Balls of Fire the Jerry Lee Lewis song, one wouldn't feel so much like stomping on it. Lewis's life, 18 months of which this movie pretends to depict, has been a string of unimaginable disasters, miscalculations, and tragedies. It's the kind of life of which people say, if it were a movie, you wouldn't believe it. They're right. In fact, extraordinary lives are terribly difficult to transform into extraordinary art, because they force the artist to make truly peculiar events feel universal. Jerry Lee Lewis's marriage to his 13-year-old cousin, Myra, which incidentally lasted for some 14 years, would require the skills of a Nabokov to navigate. Instead, director Jim McBride and his inept co-writer Jack Barron treat the whole thing as a smirking 50s joke. And God knows we've seen our share of smirking 50s jokes. Dennis Quaid gives his first truly bad performance. But bad doesn't begin to describe his strutting, grimacing, wildly actorish rendition of the killer. Jerry Lee himself recently told me he hoped the movie would kick off a whole new career for him. He'll be lucky if it doesn't bury him once and for all. A lot more fun is to be had at Lethal Weapon 2, although, let's face it, this is fun of the mindless variety. The new Lethal Weapon isn't as grim and scary as its predecessor, and it isn't as coherent either. Like Ghostbusters 2, it relies exclusively on the charms of its stars, Mel Gibson and Danny Glover, and also on little Joe Pesci as the witness they've been ordered to protect. Most of the movie is devoted to mild horsing around between car chases and gunfights. And the fun of it is more in the timing than in the wit.
Who is it?
Police, open up.
How do I know it's the police?
After I shoot you through the door, you can examine the bullet. Open up.
That was easy. Don't you want to see a badge? Don't do that again. Okay, let me see a badge.
Shut up.
Okay, I get it. Bad cop, good cop.
Shut up.
Okay. Bad cop. I got it. I know all those routines.
Leo Getz?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, that's me, Leo Getz. Whatever you need, Leo Getz. You get it?
You have to like these stars a lot to take very much of that sort of thing. And I do. What I find harder to take is the endless stream of action movie cliches, including the famous one that goes, if you can't find any other way to foil the bad guys, throw all their money in the air. Lethal Weapon 2, in short, is an agreeable enough time killer. But if you're of the opinion that time is in short supply, and certainly not deserving of capital punishment, you might want to spend yours on watching the surprise hit of the summer, a movie called Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. This is basically The Incredible Shrinking Man, only with suburban youngsters. They spend the movie making their way across a summer lawn that is instantly transformed into a jungle of beautifully imagined perils. The mad scientist who's caused it all is played by Rick Moranis in his second funny performance of the month after Ghostbusters 2. And the dialogue and atmosphere have the buoyancy that Steven Spielberg productions always seem to find in the suburbs. One more thing. The movie is playing with a new Roger Rabbit cartoon called Tummy Trouble, which has more thrills and laughs than a dozen Lethal Weapons. It may be 5 minutes long, but so far, Tummy Trouble gets my vote for the best movie of the summer.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Our production assistants, Lisa Bruton, Ed Doherty, and Steve Plever, edit and mix many of the interviews and commentaries you hear on Fresh Air. Chris Spurgeon is our director. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Mae Sarton reflects on her long life of poetry and solitude. Also, we find out what artist Chris Burden has been doing since that day in 1971 when he was shot in the name of art. And Ken Tucker examines the demise of the controversial rap group Public Enemy. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.